From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, CBS Chief Les Moonves has been accused of inappropriate workplace behavior. What action did the network's board of directors take today? Then we find out how the director and co-writer of The Spy Who Dumped Me updated the action buddy film with two women.
We wanted the women to feel empowered, but at the same time, not the sort of female action star where there's like a very male way of handling things that just happens to be played out through a woman.
And why Netflix and Amazon are once again previewing their coming attractions for TV critics. All that coming right up. The growing list of people working in Hollywood who have been accused of sexual harassment and assault now includes one of the most prominent and successful show business executives in town. Les Moonves, the chairman and CEO of the CBS Corporation, is the subject of a lengthy story in The New Yorker by investigative reporter Ronan Farrow. Published late last week, Farrow, who worked on the story for 8 months, recounts how half a dozen women accused Moonves of sexual harassment and assault between the 1980s and the late aughts. Today, the board of CBS gathered for a previously scheduled meeting and decided not to suspend Moonves while the company investigates those accusations. Moonves isn't exactly a household name, so when I called up Dawn Chmielewski, an editor at Deadline today, to discuss the story, we began with Moonves' reputation in Hollywood.
Well, this is well-regarded, both in terms of his aesthetic. He's produced a number of hit shows, the CSI series, Big Bang Theory, the most successful freshman series, Young Sheldon. He has a tremendous record of selecting hit television shows. And moreover, on Wall Street, he's well-regarded for his business acumen. He took a network that was literally in the toilet and lifted it up so that it is among the top-ranked broadcast networks year after year.
Now, we should say in Ronan Farrow's story in The New Yorker, there are certainly some allegations about CBS News and some people who work there. But let's talk about what it has to say about Les Moonves. As you read the story, what would you consider to be the most damaging allegations in the article about Les Moonves?
Well, as you know, John, ever since the Harvey Weinstein story broke last fall, there have been a number of swirling allegations around certain executives in Hollywood, and Les Moonves was a focus of some of that discussion. So what Ronan Farrow's piece did over the course of 8 months is identify six women who said they met Les at business meetings, and he forced himself on them. He tried to kiss them. He did some more egregious behavior. And when they rebuffed his advances, they contend that he sabotaged the careers.
That was specifically an allegation made by Ileana Douglas, that she said that she was essentially fired off a show that she had already been cast in after she fought Moonves off, according to the story. CBS had a regularly scheduled board meeting today, and they made an announcement saying that its board of directors is in the process of selecting outside counsel to conduct an independent investigation. No other action was taken on this matter at today's board meeting. What were some of CBS's options? It's decided not to suspend Moonves. What could it have done? What are the scenarios that it contemplated?
Obviously, the board has selected, after what appears to have been a very lengthy board meeting, to leave Les Moonves in place while they conduct their investigation. I'm not sure what other alternatives they've considered. It's still early in the reporting process. Hopefully, we'll learn more by the end of the day. But the board over the weekend was in active discussion. The directors were trying to figure out how to convey both within CBS and outside of CBS that they take this matter seriously, that they're going to look at the allegations, not just as they pertain to Les Moonves, but broader cultural issues that are raised in the New Yorker piece.
We should also add that Les Moonves is not the only person at CBS who is alleged to have sexually assaulted and harassed women. Charlie Rose, late last year, was dropped by CBS after allegations about him. We should also say in The New Yorker, there's some suggestions that the management of CBS News does not look very good either. How are these two issues all tied together, the Charlie Rose, the news issue, and Les Moonves?
Right. They suggest a broader cultural issue at play here. Is there a culture at CBS that tolerates a certain type of misconduct by what is predominantly male managers? In the case of Charlie Rose, 27 women ultimately came forward to lodge allegations of improper conduct against him. And in that case, an independent investigator was hired, and CBS ultimately dismissed him. So I guess we'll see what happens. But there's also, I understand, a broader examination of the culture that has been ongoing since the Charlie Rose revelations. So these two are not unrelated.
The CBS board says that it is going to do an internal investigation. How is CBS's handling of this story going to impact the broader conversation about how accountable powerful men in Hollywood are or are not when it comes to sexual harassment and assault?
This is a very important issue, not just for CBS, as you suggest. If I am an actress or a female showrunner, I need to know that where I'm going is a safe place to be, and that I will be treated with respect, that I will be, you know, that my talent and I will be safe. And so this has, you know, the outcome of this investigation and its seriousness will speak volumes about whether, in fact, the allegations are true and if even powerful, successful men can be held to account. One would argue that Les Moonves is perhaps even more powerful than Harvey Weinstein is.
I'm going to ask you this last question. Les Moonves is obviously maybe not as well known as Charlie Rose or Harvey Weinstein, but his fortunes and the fortunes of CBS are obviously very clearly connected because in the wake of these allegations, CBS stock has plummeted. Is that a reflection of how critical he is to the company and its future?
Absolutely. I would argue that Les Moonves is as identified with CBS as perhaps Steve Jobs was in his era at Apple. He is the one who led CBS's resurgence. He is the one who speaks to the street and also is speaks to talent. He is very strongly identified with the company and that success. So the company's fortunes in some ways are dependent upon what happens with Les.
And do you think that is somehow tied to what CBS decided not to do and not suspend Moonves today?
That's an interesting question. It's hard to get in the head of individual directors. I believe there is a bias toward giving him the benefit of the doubt. It's interesting because not too long ago, John Lasseter, an individual who was closely tied with the success of his animation studio, Pixar, and the rebirth of Disney, was placed on a 6-month suspension while the Walt Disney Company invested allegations against him. And ultimately, he was removed. So Disney took another tack. I'm not sure why CBS has chosen to leave Les Moonves in place. Perhaps it suggests that as CBS indicated in its previous statements, that there's some belief that this behavior happened years ago and isn't continuing. The investigation will obviously determine whether or not that's true.
Dawn Chmielewski is a senior editor at Deadline. Dawn, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much, John.
Coming up, director and writer Susanna Fogel turns the action comedy genre on its head with The Spy Who Dumped Me. When was the last time that you saw a spy thriller buddy film that had two women in the starring roles? That's a question that filmmaker Susanna Fogel asked herself before making her new movie, The Spy Who Dumped Me.
We have to get it to a cafe in Vienna.
Austria, Vienna?
Yes, that's what he said.
Okay, well, why don't we do that then?
Do what? Go to Europe when a bunch of people are trying to kill us?
Do you want to die having never been to Europe? Or do you want to go to Europe and die having been to Europe?
Why are those my only two options?
The new film, directed and co-written by Fogel, stars Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon. Fogel's previous film, Life Partners, was an indie comedy centering on the friendship between two women. The Spy Who Dumped Me presented a rare challenge to explore that same theme, but for a popcorn movie audience. When I spoke with Fogel in April at CinemaCon, a Las Vegas convention for movie theater owners, we started with some of the films that influenced her in making The Spy Who Dumped Me.
It's funny, I have a split personality when it comes to my taste and the writing I do. So I have this love for the sort of mid-90s indie New York, the Nicole Holof Center, Ice Storm, all of those, like that canon of movies is very much what made me want to do this in the first place.
Good Company, Ang Lee,
yeah,
and Nicole Holof
all of
Center.
That, yep. I associated my taste with theirs. It felt elevated, but at the same time, I had a love for like the popcorn movie and would see every comedy and every female-driven movie that I could and loved movies like Bridget Jones and Clueless and that whole canon. So, you know, I think that the third part of the trifecta was really when I discovered that I loved like the Bourne movies and the Bond movies and truly got invested in the idea that they were lacking good female characters. You know, either there's like a sexy assassin figure who doesn't have recognizable feelings and I don't connect to her, or there's a damsel and there wasn't enough in between. And especially when I'd watch movies that had like a little bit of that action movie quipping, the woman was never the one doing the quipping. Like, it was always a guy. The guy always got the zingers, and it started to really bother me. And I'd see these great female-driven movies by people, filmmakers like Nicole, and the women were funny, and it made the movies really accessible and great. And I just wanted to sort of see if there was a way to combine the two.
One of the conceits of The Spy Who Dumped Me is that the movie is anchored by two women, that your lead characters are both female. What made that choice necessary?
I'm a big action movie fan, and I'm also really invested in making stories about women and friendships, especially stories about female friendships that don't involve catty conflict between the women. I think it's just important to have movies that show our friendships as they are, which is filled with warmth and depth, and they're often more resonant for us than romantic relationships as we wait longer and longer to get married. And I feel like there's this primary relationship in a lot of women's lives, which is their relationship with their best friend. And there haven't been enough movies that really show that. And after making a very low budget one that had a very limited release, I wanted to see if there was a way to expand the viewership for a similar idea. So I combined it with my love for the genre of big, giant spectacle popcorn movies for this. And so I think it was important that it be two women because it's still a story I felt needed to be told. I couldn't think of a movie that had done it before. So I just wanted to be the one.
I've heard in the presentations at Show West, three different actresses say the reason that they're now working in action movies or superhero movies is because everything before had been a damsel in distress role, mm-hmm. that they were the person being rescued. And your movie has a slightly different idea in that the women are doing the rescuing, which seems a critical difference from a lot of what's come before.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that's important, that was important to both David and me, my co-writer, is trying to bring as much groundedness to an admittedly over-the-top plot. So having a friendship and having characters that are active and proactive, but also, you know, if they leave a building and cause a ton of destruction, they're like, oh my God, we caused all this destruction. What just happened? As opposed to just kind of walking away from the explosion with nothing. So we wanted to be as grounded as we possibly could and use our love for observational comedy, which had previously just been relegated to television and indie movies, in this big world. So we wanted the women to feel empowered, but at the same time, not the sort of canon of female action star where there's like a very male way of handling things that just happens to be played out through a woman. So I feel like I just think there need to be more stories about women everywhere on the spectrum, of competent to incompetent to Naked Gun to Bourne to everything. And then each one won't carry the weight of representing everything about women in these situations. But yeah, I mean, we wanted these women to find themselves through this journey.
We're talking with Susanna Fogel. She's the co-writer and director of The Spy Who Dumped Me. At what point do you feel it's important and non-negotiable that you're going to direct this movie?
You know, this was a special case. I think because we'd written the script and because we felt like it was something that had the potential to be commercial, and for the first time felt like we had written something that people would want, as opposed to the constant process of begging and feeling low status, which like is a screenwriter's life pretty much usually. We felt like we had the ability to just kind of assume that it was going to come to pass that I would direct it, and we never asked. And I don't know whether that's because we felt like we didn't have anything to lose, because again, we were doing this at a otherwise low point in both of our careers. So we sort of had this strange, like rock bottom confidence coming out of nowhere, Phoenix Rising for the Ashes style, where we just decided to announce that we were doing it and see who got on board this moving train, as opposed to the normal kind of, I hope I don't encounter roadblocks. What am I going to say if people doubt me? We didn't really consider that possibility. And I'm not sure how that happened, because I've never conducted myself in that way, but for whatever reason it worked out. So
it's basically take it or leave it, that I'm your director, and if you don't want to hire me, then you're not making this movie.
you know, I was lucky in that I didn't feel like there was pushback on the basis of gender. And I think the timing was right for studios to feel like they want to be on the side of progress and they want to be open to that. So I wasn't aware of anything like that. But I do feel like, and I feel strongly about this, I think female directors can sometimes handicap themselves by not conducting themselves with enough confidence. We're handicapped by the outside world our whole careers, but we kind of have to go into a room and own it as though we have been blessed with the confidence and privilege of people that didn't deal with that. Otherwise, it doesn't inspire confidence in the buyers, the investors. So you sort of, it's like a fake it till you make it thing. And I do think it's culturally harder for women to behave that way. It just doesn't come as naturally to us because we've been told to invest a lot of our energy in people pleasing. And I think the reputation of women as either pushovers or the word you don't use is quickly becoming, I hope, dated. But I think there's a way to sort of be a benevolent dictator on a set and inspire respect without having to shut people out, and to be collaborative and a good listener and empathetic and all the things that people associate with women, and still inspire, you know, people to follow your lead. Just being diligent in your hiring process, I think, is a big step towards making the sets feel like gender blind.
The summer movie season is filled with a lot of franchises and a lot of pre-existing movies that are getting spin-off sequels. Your film was scheduled to open opposite Ant-Man, Wasp, and the latest Purge movie. Is it really hard to find a date where a movie can have a life of its own, especially a movie that is an original idea that's not part of some pre-existing franchise?
I think so. I mean, I think our hope for the movie is that it's something that women will hopefully see it because there are female leads, but also it was really important to me to have legit action that would attract any audience and to sort of bring a wider audience into this movie that's ultimately a pretty personal friendship story. But in that way, it ideally falls between genres. And some of the movies that we were looking at that were that July 4th weekend also did that. And I think we wanted to just make sure that people knew that this is like a unique offering for them. You know, if you go to the theater and they want something that's like an action comedy with female leads, we just didn't want them to have many choices. So if that's something that they wanted, we wanted to be the one. And hopefully that will serve the movie well. And I don't know.
I think every movie of any budget is always kind of a referendum. Does this idea work? Does this director work? Is this idea commercial? And yet the stakes change dramatically when it's a female director with female leads. How do we get away from that world where a movie like yours is a test of greater magnitude than the other movies that are coming out every week of the year?
I'm hoping that there just are more creators, more content, more stories. You know, it's funny, like even reading reviews of movies that are coming out now that are female driven, they're all compared to each other, even though the only thing they have in common is that they're female driven. So, you know, reading about Blockers being compared to I Feel Pretty, being compared to potentially our movie, those are three really different movies. There's this genre of women's movies that shouldn't be one genre. I mean, we should just, more representation is the only way out of it, I think. But until then, our movie will be compared to Clueless and Wonder Woman, as though those are both viable comparisons for one movie.
Susanna, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes.
Up next on The Frame, TV networks and streaming services are previewing their coming attractions for critics and reporters. What can viewers look forward to seeing this fall? Right now, the 200-plus members of the Television Critics Association have set up shop in the Beverly Hilton for their summer press tour. It's one of the two times a year, in January and July, when TV networks, cable channels, and now streaming services talk up their best new shows to a roomful of the nation's TV critics and reporters. This year, Netflix and Amazon are back after skipping tours in recent years. That's significant given how much they have changed the way that we all watch television. Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. He's also the president of the Television Critics Association. When I reached him on the line from his hotel room today, I asked him why he thought the streaming companies came back to meet with the TCA this time around.
They were away for a couple tours, and I think that that's just a part of the organic process. Everyone is trying to figure out how to sell their stuff. And I think that Amazon and Netflix both recognize that it's just good to get your shows and your executives in front of a room full of reporters who really just want to cover your stuff. And so it was very exciting to have Amazon back for a few panels with their new executives and their new regime to talk about sort of how things have changed. And then we had a full day of Netflix where it wasn't so much about how things have changed as, oh my goodness, we have so many shows. Here are some of the ones we want to highlight.
Let's talk first about Amazon. Amazon had done something very interesting, and that was that they had online polling for some of their pilots where people would check out the pilots and vote yay or nay. Are they getting rid of that right now?
I believe that they're stepping away from it. Their new head of programming, Jen Psaki, who comes from NBC, where they don't obviously have that process, admitted that at least for now it's not something they're moving forward with. And the thing that Psaki mentioned that I think is probably most important, and a thing that it should be noted critics asked Amazon about many times at previous panels, is that they would have that pilot season, and people would really fall in love with the pilot of a show, and then they'd pick the show up about 2.5 months later, and then the show would appear on Amazon 9 or 10 months or a year after that, and there was just no way to maintain any sort of momentum. And so the thing that was supposed to be most immediate and best about the process never really could work.
One of the things that Netflix is famous for is not saying how many people are watching certain series. I'm sure they're not canceling Everything Sucks because everybody in America was watching it. What does the cancellation of Everything Sucks tell us about Netflix and how it's making its programming decisions?
I think it's a very interesting example of what is happening now at Netflix now that they've started to cancel some shows. With Everything Sucks, the primary thing that Cindy Holland, their programming executive who spoke to us, emphasized is that although she loved the show and that although a core group of fans loved the show, they have very, very specific data on how viewers watch everything. And the bottom line, as she put it to us, was that too many people were starting the show and not finishing it. And that's obviously, if you're a binge-heavy network, not the thing you want to see. You want people to carry through for all 8, 10, 13 episodes.
Now, when I think of Facebook and YouTube, I think of Facebook as a way of checking out where your friends are going for summer vacation and YouTube maybe to watch an animal fail video. But Facebook now has Facebook Watch and YouTube has something called YouTube Premium. Let's talk first about Facebook and Facebook Watch. What are their intentions, goals, and what is their commitment to original programming?
Their commitment to original programming is that they have a lot of money and they're attempting to make a hefty commitment to original programming. And that is the kind of thing that you pretty much have to do in this marketplace. Is if you have the resources and you are in the business where the best way to make money is to keep people on your platform for as long as possible, giving them long-form programming is really and truly the best way of doing that. This was Facebook's first appearance at Press Tour, and they didn't really do a very good job of explaining what exactly is going to be on Facebook Watch, how it's actually going to work, etc. Whereas with YouTube Premium, the artist formerly known as YouTube Red, thanks to Cobra Kai, they actually have a really good poster boy for what their model is. They'd had a bunch of shows, and some of them had gotten a tiny bit of attention previously, but Cobra Kai had a lot of people talking about it. They were able to give absurd numbers regarding how many people had watched bits and pieces of the show in different formats.
It was like a billion, right?
Yes. And I have no idea what those numbers are associated with, but yes, they said like 1 billion hours of Cobra Kai programming was watched. What does that mean? I don't know. But I do know that people talked about Cobra Kai, and it even got an Emmy nomination. And I think it's a good calling card for what YouTube Premium has the potential to do in the marketplace, which is something significant.
So you have not yet heard from the major broadcast networks, Fox, NBC, ABC, the CW, CBS, but let's talk a little bit about CBS. There was a huge New Yorker story that came out late last week about some alleged sexual misconduct, harassment, assaults by CBS CEO Les Moonves. Even though CBS has not yet presented its schedule and its new shows, what kind of conversations have there been around Les Moonves so far at the TCA?
It's come up in isolated panels so far. For example, Chuck Lorre was on a panel for his upcoming Netflix comedy with Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin, and he was asked about what that said about the environment at CBS, where he has obviously been a stalwart and important figure. And basically, he demurred to say anything specifically about Les Moonves, but he did emphasize that you can't make good television in a toxic environment. And this is a person who has worked with Cybill Shepherd, Roseanne, and Charlie Sheen. So he knows of what he speaks, even if he speaks vaguely. It's going to be very interesting to see how CBS handles this at their day. As of last week, before any of this broke, they were scheduled to have an executive session and a full day of panels, and I certainly hope that they still will. They just have now basically a week to make sure that everybody is on the same corporate page on it, whatever it is.
Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He is also the president of the TCA. Daniel, as always, a pleasure. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And that is it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.